From the Imperia Project at the Davis Center for Russian and Eurasian Studies, I'm Kelly O'Neill. This is The Mapmaker. Welcome to part three of our three-part exploration of one of the most interesting, fascinating maps of the 19th century. We left off with a total cliffhanger last time, and it must have been hard to wait even a few hours, let alone a few days, to dig into this.
Yeah, I mean, I had to wait a few weeks. It was April break. I was on the edge of my seat the whole time.
I can't make you wait any longer. We need to figure out who this crazy Englishman was who in a sense, made this map.
Yes.
All right, so where should we begin?
So Thomas Bess Jarvis, who was the somewhat map maker of this map, he wasn't the first one to make a map of Crimea, let alone he wasn't even the first one to make a map of Crimea that looked pretty similar to this. So how did he do it?
That is such a good point. Many, many people have made maps of Crimea. Good maps, bad maps, maps that look like strange amoeba-like blobs, right? There are lots of maps of Crimea floating around. He had a lot to work with. I suppose it makes sense to at least acknowledge the fact that he was born at a certain point in time, right? He was born in 1796. And just to put that in a little bit of perspective, that is the year that Catherine the Great died. So she dies and he's born. And he was born not in England at all. He was born in Sri Lanka. It was called Ceylon at the time.
Oh.
Mm-hmm. Interesting, right? Very. And he was born into a family that was very English in a sense. They had roots going back to King Edward III in the 14th century on one side. Yeah. So he's, you know, not no one. His mother is described as being of Polish extraction on her father's side. And on her mother's side, she was a descendant of the Brothers Grimm of fairy tale fame.
Oh, okay.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. So he was kind of destined to do great and wonderful things, I suppose.
Yeah, to be a map maker is to be a storyteller in some sense, you could say.
I love it. That's so true. Mm-hmm. If we can fast forward through his childhood, we won't get all Freudian on Thomas Bess Jarvis. What is important to know mm-hmm. is that lots of stories that are told about the 19th century in Europe have the same root. And the root of all of those stories is Napoleon.
Yes.
And in a way, Napoleon is at the foundation of this story, too, because Napoleon very famously tried to march hundreds of thousands of soldiers all the way across Europe and invade Moscow. Never a good idea, especially in winter, right? And he suffered this horrible, horrible defeat. And one of the reasons why he was defeated, all of the generals in Europe all agreed that one of the reasons he lost was because he didn't really know where he was going. And he didn't really know anything about the geography of the terrain.
There was no GPS he could whip out. No.
No GPS. Yeah. Nope. Mm-hmm. Nope. And no one wanted to repeat that error. And so all of a sudden, military officers became obsessed with geographical knowledge, information, and maps.
So in that way, Napoleon's failure to, you know, conquer Moscow became very much a cautionary tale for these people.
Absolutely. Mm-hmm. I guess we could really push on it and say if we didn't have Napoleon's defeat, we wouldn't have Google Maps on our phones. Like, it's entirely possible.
Every time, you know, you have to navigate, you know, you pull out your little Google Maps to take a 5-minute walk, think about Napoleon.
So Thomas Bess Jarvis was part of the British response to Napoleon's defeat. So mm-hmm. He does really well for himself in school, and he essentially gets assigned to being a surveyor and map maker for the Ordnance Survey. But before working on that, he gets sent to British India, and he is charged with making survey maps of British territory in India.
For the people listening, do you want to just give a little bit maybe background on kind of British imperialism in India and just kind of like what they were doing there and what the use of a map would have been of their territory in India?
Yeah, sure. So really British power in India is something, this is a story that happens in the second half of the 18th century, the 1780s in particular. And the rise of great empires like the British kind of went hand in hand and lockstep with the rise of lots of new technologies, right? And so map making is one of those technologies. And it wasn't just military officers who were convinced that maps mattered. Civilian officials, tax collectors, landowners, people who cared about making a profit of any kind, really came to think that all of this depended on the quality and depth of the knowledge of the state, of its territory. So Jervis got sent out there in 1820, and he was in charge of surveying about 13,000 square miles of really mountainous territory just south of Bombay. And he spent 10 years working on that project.
Before we really get into it, I just want to say that in this time, most people didn't have a great idea of what the world looked like. So in that way, it was no small feat, I guess, is what I'm trying to say.
Absolutely.
And that speaks to why it maybe took 10 years, but if you want to get more into that, please.
Yeah, no, I think you're right. I mean, he's essentially sketching a portrait of a huge amount of territory that could be sent home, used, you know, on the spot, but also sent home. I think that's a really good way to think about it.
Yeah. So how did that go for him, those 10 years?
Well, I think his self-report would be that he did a great job.
Oh, obviously.
He was really, really proud of being part of the survey project. And one of his superiors definitely praised him. I think his work is very high quality. He was known for his meticulous kind of contour lines. He didn't make a lot of mistakes. And he felt really good about himself. And at the end of about 20 years in India, actually, he came home in 1840. He came home to England. And he got involved in some really important projects in England. For example, did you know that Thomas Bess Jervis was a crusader against dueling?
Really?
He felt like the entire project of modern civilization depended on eradicating dueling from England. So he devoted considerable time and resources to that when he wasn't also making maps.
What a guy.
I think he was a very religious man. He had a very conservative religious kind of sense of morality. And that was part of his project. Yeah. But meanwhile, he did also establish a lithography studio. He was drawing, he was creating maps and doing all kinds of fun things. And as the 1840s gave way to the 1850s, we've talked about the fact that things started going sour politically, geopolitically in Europe.
Yeah. You say they were going sour. What exactly does that mean? What did that look like?
So I guess there are two main things that were happening. One is that the guy who sat on the throne in St. Petersburg was a hardliner. He was known as the gendarme of Europe. I don't think he was the friendliest, warmest kind of guy. Nicholas I, kind of known to put down any kind of rebellion with a fair amount of force.
And there were a lot of rebellions going on.
There were, especially the Poles. Yeah, the Poles were rebelling all the time, and they really put a bee in the bonnet of Nicholas I. So that's kind of going on in Russia. And at the same time, the Ottoman Empire was very famously beginning to weaken.
Yeah, there was, I know they were kind of lagging behind the modernization of a lot of these other empires and states. And then when they did try to modernize, it didn't go so hot for them. And so it ended up with a lot of kind of just disintegration, internal disintegration.
Yeah, they got caught in this really uncomfortable spot where they were getting a lot of reform ideas pushed on them by the British, who were trying to prop them up so that the Ottomans could stand in the south against the Russians in the Black Sea, kind of caught between their own internal interests and needs and the interests and needs of these external powers. Right? It was not an easy time, I think, to be in charge of the Ottoman Empire.
Looking at Thomas Bess Jervis back in England now in his map making studio, what role is he beginning to play in all of this?
Yeah. So back in England, Thomas is already convinced that maps are really effective tools for states, mm-hmm. right, to use. And the world, the European world, is kind of beginning to come apart. The idea that war is about to break out between the Russians and the Ottomans and the Black Sea, it's all over the newspapers, everyone's talking about it. And it just so happens that in the spring of 1854, which was just as the war was beginning to break out, Thomas was visiting a friend in Belgium. And that's the moment when he comes across a copy of a very rare map of Crimea that had been made by a Russian general staff officer back in 1816. This was described at the time as a document that, quote, no money could purchase.
Wow.
Right? Mm-hmm. He also at the same time came across an equally rare Austrian map of Turkey in the same place. And both of those maps had been kept out of circulation. They hadn't been published for the public consumption for very good reason. And they were known as absolutely unprocurable by the British. And Thomas discovered them as he's in the personal library of some very well-connected friend.
What luck. Can you talk about why these were so unprocurable? Procurable for the British government as much as they probably wanted them?
Wanted them, yeah. I mean, it's a really interesting question of, it's hard to keep a secret, right? And
yeah.
Military secrets, map secrets, think about the news cycle these days. I mean, mm-hmm. these things get out in the world eventually, yeah. right? Every secret has a half-life. In the 19th century, imperial governments considered geographical information to be pretty much top secret, especially the Russians. They were not in the business of publishing really large scale, really detailed information, especially if that information described a place like Crimea, which was on the frontier between the Russian Empire and the Ottoman Empire, and especially if you think about the Ottoman Empire as kind of a proxy for the British.
Yeah.
Right? I mean, this is strategically sensitive territory.
It's crazy because the map that we're looking at, it's all Crimea. But if you look at Crimea on a world map, it's like a tiny blip. So it really speaks to how, even though geographically it's just this little morsel of the world, if you think about it militarily, if you think about it strategically, it was so critical.
Yeah. Absolutely. Like, perspective and scale are really, really important. I think you really put your finger on something important there. And there was this huge thirst for information, right? The British knew that war was about to break out. And mm-hmm. so here's Thomas Best Jarvis sitting in his friend's library, and he comes across, in scare quotes, right, this incredible, unprocurable map. So what would you do if you were him?
You know, take out my phone, take a picture? No. Copies it.
Yeah, exactly. Mm-hmm. And I'm sure he wishes he had an iPhone, right?
Yeah.
But no, so he sat there for about 2 weeks and meticulously copied every single detail. And he fancied himself the master of all languages. So he took it upon himself to translate all of the Russian place names that the original map maker had put on the map. He translated them into English.
How'd he do?
He did pretty well, okay. I have to say. Okay. He really did well. He skips some of them, and he does, you know, mix a few letters up here and there. But all in all, he did a pretty good job.
They don't call him the best Jarvis for nothing. Anyway.
So he does this whole thing, right? He copies this map. He copies the Austrian map. And he's so excited about it. He's like, you know, he was super proud when he made his maps of India. He's super proud of himself now. And he basically, I think in his own mind, saw himself as the hero of the British Empire. So he can just imagine him packing his suitcase, rolling up his map, going back to London and making a beeline for the Foreign Office, right? Mm-hmm. And he basically goes straight to Sir Charles Trevelyan. Is that a name that you've ever encountered in your history courses?
No, I can't say it is.
No.
Yeah.
That is completely fine, but I'm going to tell you one thing that you need to know about Sir Charles Trevelyan.
Yes.
He was also a former East India Company guy, mm-hmm. but that's not the important thing. Since 1840, he had served as Assistant Secretary of Her Majesty's Treasury, and he's best known for his role in the Irish famine. So if you are of Irish American stock and grew up in Massachusetts, yeah, as I did, you know this guy because your grandmother told you stories about how Sir Charles Trevelyan is single-handedly responsible for famine in Ireland and the death of millions of Irish peasants.
But that's another story for another day. So Thomas Jarvis beelines for Charles. What's his last name? Charles
Trevelyan.
Charles Trevelyan. How does that go?
It goes badly. Yeah, it's kind of a disaster. I think Jarvis was all kind of hot and bothered. He enters the private room at the Treasury office, and Trevelyan had also invited the Duke of Newcastle, who was the Secretary of War, to come. And there were a few other guys in the room. And Jarvis kind of ceremonially spreads out this map on this gigantic table. And when he did, the Secretary of War was totally astonished, because there on the table laid out before him were all of the kind of strategic treasures of the enemy, right? The roads, the rivers, the wells. Remember, we even saw a little, you know, freshwater springs and everything. So the Secretary of War is all excited. And there's another guy in the room, and his name was Lord Fitzroy Somerset, but people know him better as Lord Raglan. If you happen to be a military history buff, you know that he was the commander of British troops in Crimea. And he's also, he's looking at this map, and he's a little bit less astonished when he looks at the map. And he actually announces that he possessed a copy of it, which is a bit strange and takes everyone by surprise. But his copy, and he actually says this, being in Russian was like hieroglyphics. So he claims to have a copy of this map, but it's completely unusable because he couldn't read the text. Oh. So all of a sudden, people are kind of trading secrets about this map. And it came out that Emperor Napoleon III had a copy too, but no one was using it. And everyone had essentially forgotten about it. And even though the Secretary of War was absolutely thrilled to have this thing on the table in front of him, everyone in the government completely, their cheeks went white when they thought about how much it would cost to print the map and distribute it. And they all decided it couldn't possibly be worth printing this map and making copies of it and sending it to officers in the field.
Yeah, because we described the map in the first episode, but just to remind you, there are these tiny, tiny little marks like all throughout it, like so precise, which I guess is what Thomas Jarvis was really priding himself on, but it was the downfall of that moment.
Yeah, I mean, it's gigantic, right?
It's gigantic.
It's unwieldy.
Yeah.
They were going to be able to use lithography and kind of make prints. They wouldn't have to hand copy it. Mm-hmm. But yeah, it was going to be a really involved process, very costly. Jarvis was, if you can imagine him coming in kind of guns blazing at the end of that meeting, he's just totally deflated. He's so disappointed. And he goes on a letter writing campaign and tries to convince everyone he'll pay for it out of his own pocket. And he tells, you know, Trevelyan and Newcastle about what he describes as the tendency of the Russians to use false intelligence and intrigues, sowing dissension among opponents, using bribes and flatteries, which is a very, you know, it's not a complimentary portrait that he's painting of the Russian enemy, right? But what the bigger point there is that people, that he knows that the Russians are very carefully using the distribution of false information for their own purposes.
And he's saying that this is more objective. We don't have to go off what the enemy is telling us anymore if we can use this map.
Exactly. This is the antidote to false information.
Yes.
Exactly. Yes. So he's so insistent. He's a persuasive kind of compelling guy. He goes ahead. He starts printing copies, and eventually the government comes around and they do agree to pay him back and fund an English edition and even a French edition. So soon enough, all of the officers involved, and I don't know how high up in the ranks you had to be, but officers of a certain class all had their own copy of this map before they set foot on Crimean territory. And this was just the coup of his lifetime, up to that point anyway.
What does he do after reaching this, you know, all-time high?
Well, you know, he's really happy with himself again. His life is like a roller coaster. Mm-hmm. the British win the war, essentially. They don't win it on their own. It's kind of a group of allies who win, and the Russians are humiliated. And his next step, he decides, is to convince the British government that they should always have great maps of any place they want to go and invade or fight a battle in.
His work ends up being the reason why we have a lithography and statistics bureau in the UK. Is that how you would say it?
Yeah, that is basically what happens. He creates this, you know, the beautiful copy that we were looking at with the ceremonial title and the couplet and all of these wonderful elements was eventually presented to Queen Victoria.
Yes.
She was very impressed. Everyone was very impressed. Everyone had come around to the idea of geographical intelligence being part of military operations. So yeah, it's just a couple of years later that he is able to convince the War Office and the Treasury to establish an Office for Military Intelligence. And so in 1855, he becomes the director of the Topographical and Statistical Depot of the War Department, which doesn't have a great ring to it.
Yeah, what's the acronym for that?
Exactly. Yeah. It might not scream spy office to you, but that's essentially what it was. Jervis and his men, they got straight to work. They didn't waste any time mapping Eastern Anatolia, the Euphrates River. They basically run around making groundbreaking maps of the Caucasus. And Jervis and his merry men kept working to convince the government that this was essential to the preservation of the empire. And they keep at it, they keep at it. The office gets renamed a few times. You know, the government reorganizes, they give things different names. It becomes the sixth department of military intelligence, which does have an acronym, MI6.
Sounds a little familiar, yeah.
It does. If you've ever watched a James Bond movie, MI6, we have James Bond. All because of Thomas Best Jervis.
Again, so every time you open your GPS, you think Napoleon, and every time you watch a James Bond movie, you think Thomas Best Jervis. That's what we've learned today.
That is what we have learned today. We have done good work.
We have.